So this deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel.
Oh, yeah, CertFuel.
Yeah, they've got this full Series 6 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted, just like the real thing.
Right.
So check it out at CertFuel.com.
Absolutely.
Okay, so imagine hitting send on just a single email to your clients and instantly creating, well, massive civil liability for your entire firm.
Yeah, nightmare scenario.
Right. Triggering a regulatory audit, potentially ending your career in finance, all because you blind copied one too many people.
Just one extra email address, yeah.
Exactly. So today we are exploring the sort of the invisible tripwires of the FNRA communications rule.
It's a minefield.
It really is. And let
Yeah.
me tell you, if you don't know exactly what bucket a message falls into, you're going to completely fail the questions on who approves it, what disclosures it needs, and like how long you have to keep a record of it.
That is the perfect way to frame it, honestly, because the category of the communication is the absolute foundation of everything else in this rule.
Right.
It dictates the entire regulatory workflow. I mean, if you get the category wrong, you get the approval process wrong. And when you get the approval process wrong in the real world, your firm gets heavily fined and you lose your license.
Which is bad.
Yeah, very bad. And on the exam, you just lose easy points.
Right.
So the rules we are looking at today, they aren't just, administrative red tape. They are the actual barricades that FINRA and the SEC put up to protect the investing public from misleading information.
Right. And to make sure we don't lose those points on the exam, and I mean, to give us a way to visualize this chaos, we're going to follow a couple of characters today.
Okay, I like this.
Yeah. So I want you to imagine a Series 6 registered rep named Reckless Rick.
Reckless Rick.
Yeah, Rick is a guy who he thinks he is an absolute marketing genius, but he fundamentally hates rules.
Oh, I know this guy.
We all know this guy. He thinks compliance is just sort of a suggestion that slows down his commissions.
We have all worked with a reckless Rick. I mean, they are the exact reason compliance departments drink heavily.
Exactly. And the guy whose job it is to prevent Rick from, burning the broker-dealer to the ground is Sensible Sam.
Poor Sam.
Yeah, Sensible Sam is the exhausted compliance principal. He has a perpetual headache, he drinks way too much dark roast coffee, and he basically spends his entire day cleaning up Rick's messes.
Sounds accurate.
So as we go through this material, we are going to follow Rick's disasters to help us lock in these rules.
I love it.
So let's start with how we actually categorize the chaos when Rick, sits down in his computer to send a message. Because every single written or electronic message a broker-dealer sends falls into one of three buckets, right?
Right. Under the FINRA communications rule, those three categories are based purely on the audience receiving the message.
Okay, the audience.
Not the content, but the audience. So those buckets are correspondence, retail communication, and institutional communication.
Okay, let's unpack those, starting with correspondence. What makes a message fall into the correspondence bucket?
So correspondence is defined as any written or electronic communication that is distributed or made available to 25 or fewer retail investors within any 30 calendar day period.
Okay, 25 or fewer.
Yeah.
So if Reckless Rick decides to send a highly customized, maybe slightly aggressive email, pitching a new mutual fund to 10 of his old college buddies, that is correspondence.
Yes.
Because it's a small group, it's 25 or fewer.
Exactly. It's a limited audience. Now compare that to the second bucket, which is a retail communication.
Right.
A retail communication is any written or electronic message distributed or made available to more than 25 retail investors within any 30 calendar day period.
So Rick takes that exact same email, but instead of just his 10 college buddies, he blasts it out to his entire contact list of like 500 retail clients.
Right.
Suddenly, we have crossed that magic threshold. We are over 25. We are now in retail communication territory.
Precisely. And we have to stop here and talk about the why behind this rule, because understanding the underlying logic makes it so much easier to remember on exam day.
Yeah, please, because 25 just seems like a random number.
Right. Why do the SEC and FINRA care so deeply about the number 25? Well, it all comes down to systemic risk and the blast radius of bad information.
Okay, blast radius.
Yeah, if Rick sends a misleading, terrible email with a wild guarantee to 10 people, that is obviously bad.
Right.
But the blast radius is contained, it's a localized problem. Therefore, correspondence just requires sensible Sam to supervise and review it, often after the fact.
Because reviewing every single one-off email before it's sent would just grind business to a halt.
Exactly. The regulatory burden has to match the risk. But if Rick blasts an email to hundreds or thousands of people, the potential to harm the investing public is massive.
Right, it could spark a panic or something.
Yeah. Or it could lead to widespread fraud. Therefore, retail communications require strict registered principal pre-approval. Sensible Sam has to read it, approve it, and sign off on it before it ever leaves the building.
So Sam has to catch the grenade before Rick throws it.
That is exactly it.
That makes total sense. Now, the third bucket is institutional communication. This one feels a bit more, exclusive.
It is. An institutional communication is a written or electronic communication distributed or made available only to institutional investors.
So who are we talking about there?
We are talking about banks, savings and loans, insurance companies, registered investment companies like mutual funds, government entities, or any entity, which actually includes an individual, with $50 million or more in total assets.
Okay, so if they have that much money, the SEC basically assumes they are sophisticated enough to fend for themselves without Sensible Sam holding their hand.
That's the exact regulatory logic, yeah. Institutional investors just don't need the same simplified, plain English disclosures that retail investors do.
Right.
Because of that, institutional communications only require supervision, just like correspondence. They do not require principal pre-approval.
All right. I want to plant a massive red flag here for our listener.
Yeah.
Because this is where the exam tries to get you. It is the rolling 30-day trap.
Oh, the rolling 30 days. Yes.
Let's walk through how the math works on that 25-person threshold. Because it's not just a per email blast count.
Mm.
It's way sneakier than that, right?
It is much sneakier. The rule explicitly specifies a rolling 30 calendar day period. It is not calculated per mailing or per campaign.
Okay.
So let's say Rick creates a beautiful, wildly non-compliant, glossy brochure.
Typical, right?
Right. He prints it out, and on Monday, he drops it in the mail to 20 retail investors.
Okay, so under the 25 threshold.
Yeah.
So far, he's in the clear. It's just correspondence. Sam can just review it later.
Right. But then, let's say 3 weeks later, Rick decides that brochure is working really great. So he mails that exact same brochure to 10 different retail investors.
Ah, 20 plus 10 is 30.
Exactly. He just hit 30 retail investors within a 30-day window with the same material.
Wow.
That means the brochure retroactively becomes a retail communication.
Retroactively. That is terrifying.
Yep. The second he drops those 10 new envelopes in the mail, he has committed a major FINRA violation.
Because it's over 25 now.
Right. And because a retail communication requires principal pre-approval before first use, and Rick never got Sam to pre-approve it because he thought it was just correspondence.
Sensible Sam's eye just started twitching, and he doesn't even know why yet.
Sure.
That is a brutal trap. You can't just space out your spam by a few days to beat the regulatory system.
No, you can't.
Because if an auditor sits in Sam's office and looks at the postage receipts, they will catch that rolling 30-day violation instantly.
They absolutely will.
Now, there's another major trap I want to cover, and it's what I call the institutional gotcha. For this, let's introduce a new character. Let's call her Wealthy Wendy.
Okay, Wealthy Wendy.
Yeah, Wendy is an investor, an individual human being, but she has $60 million in total assets.
Which is a critical detail. Anyone with $50 million or more in total assets qualifies as an institutional investor under the FINRA communications rule. It doesn't have to be a bank. It can be an individual person as long as they cross that $50 million line.
Right. So Rick wants to impress Wealthy Wendy and get her business. He puts together this highly sophisticated, complex, institutional-grade pitch deck.
Okay.
He emailed it to Wealthy Wendy, and he also sends it to 50 hedge funds and commercial banks. So far, looking at the recipient list, this is a pure institutional communication.
Yes. Everyone on the recipient list meets the strict institutional definition. So it only requires supervision, not pre-approval.
But here's where Reckless Rick ruins everything.
Mm.
Rick is so proud of this pitch deck. He thinks it's his masterpiece. He wants to show off.
Oh, no.
So on that email to Wendy and the 50 hedge funds, Rick BCCs his mother.
Of course he does.
Just one normal, everyday retail investor who definitely doesn't have $50 million.
Yeah.
What happens to the legal status of this email?
The entire communication immediately downgrades. The rule is incredibly strict on this point. An institutional communication must go only to institutional investors. One single retail drop poisons the entire institutional well.
poisons the well. I like that.
Yeah, because Rick's mom received it, it can no longer be classified as institutional. And the danger here is that institutional pieces often contain complex language, or they lack the plain English risk disclosures required for retail folks.
Right, so his mom is completely unprotected.
Exactly.
So because his mom got it, what bucket does it fall into now? Like, is it retail?
Well, this is actually an interesting nuance that tests your grasp of the definitions. Because it went to one retail investor, it is no longer institutional.
Right.
But since it only went to one retail investor, his mom, it would technically become correspondence.
Oh, wow. Because it's 25 or fewer retail investors? Wait, so the 50 hedge funds on the email don't count toward the 25 retail limit?
Exactly. You only count the retail investors. The hedge funds are completely invisible to that specific 25-person threshold.
That is wild.
It is. But let's change the scenario slightly. Let's say he BCC'd his mom and 26 of his cousins. Then it leaps straight from institutional, skips right over correspondence, and becomes a full-blown retail communication requiring pre-approval.
That makes sense.
The core takeaway the exam will test is that you cannot call it an institutional communication if even one retail investor is on the list.
That is fascinating. The contamination is instant.
It's absolutely instant.
Okay, I want to pause here. We've got a direct question for the listener to test this logic. So if you're listening, think about this.
Right.
Reckless Rick is absolutely furious that the office coffee machine is broken again.
Naturally.
Naturally. He writes a massive, angry, firm-wide email complaining about the coffee machine, and he blasts it to 200 of his own colleagues at the broker-dealer. 200 people.
Okay.
What category of communication is this? Is it retail, correspondence, or institutional? Give yourself a second to lock in an answer.
Have you got it?
Yeah. What is it?
The answer is it's none of them.
It's a total trick question.
It totally is. Internal communications are completely excluded from all three finer communication categories.
Yeah.
Fenaray's mandate is to protect the investing public. They do not care about Rick's coffee complaints, nor do they care about internal memos regarding HR policies or firm-wide software updates.
And that makes total sense.
Internal messages to other employees of the member firm just do not fall under the specific communications rule.
So Sensible Sam does not need to pre-approve a rant about dark roast.
Thankfully, no.
I love it. Okay, so we've got a solid handle on the three buckets for written and electronic stuff. But let's transition to a totally different arena. What happens when Reckless Rick puts down his keyboard, steps away from the brochures, and actually opens his mouth in public? How do the rules handle live speech?
So live speech falls under a completely separate category, and it's called a public appearance.
Okay, public appearance.
Yes. Yeah. This covers unscripted speaking activities. We are talking about live seminars, radio interviews, television appearances, interactive electronic forums, or really any unscripted public speaking engagement.
Let's unpack the logic here, because Sensible Sam's entire job is to protect the public from Rick's terrible ideas. But if Rick is speaking live on a local morning radio show, Sam can't just jump through the microphone and bleep him out.
Right. Time travel doesn't exist.
Yeah, he can't pre-approve words that Rick hasn't even thought of saying yet.
Exactly. The regulatory framework has to recognize the reality of live unscripted speech.
Mm-hmm.
Because it is unscripted and happening in real time, a principal physically cannot pre-approve it. So the regulatory burden shifts.
How so?
Instead of pre-approval, the firm must have written supervisory procedures in place to supervise the appearance, and, crucially, they must provide education and training to the representative beforehand.
So Sam has to sit Rick down in a chair before he goes to the radio station and say, you know, Rick, look at me. Do not guarantee returns.
Yes.
Do not promise our mutual funds will make them millionaires. Do not say the word tax-free. Here's the training manual. Read it.
Yes. Sam trains Rick. Documents of the training happened to satisfy the regulators, and then he likely monitors the broadcast to make sure Rick didn't go completely off the rails.
I want to push this to the extreme, because absurd analogies always help this stuff stick.
Let's hear it.
Let's say Rick goes to a monster truck rally.
Okay.
It's incredibly loud, engines are roaring, and Rick is standing in the bleachers with a literal megaphone.
Naturally.
He is completely unscripted, just yelling off the top of his head to 30 random people in the crowd about the diversification benefits of international mutual funds.
That is a public appearance, right?
I mean, as ridiculous as the setting is, yes, it is live, unscripted public speaking. It's a public appearance.
Okay. But what if Rick realizes he's rambling and he's sort of losing the monster truck crowd? So he reaches into his pocket, pulls out a piece of paper, and starts reading a prepared speech word for word into the megaphone to those same 30 people in the bleachers.
Ah, the second he starts reading from a written script to more than 25 retail investors, it instantly transforms.
Transforms how?
It is no longer a public appearance. It is legally a retail communication.
Wow. The mere presence of the paper changes the entire regulatory category. It changes everything because a script can be pre-approved.
Oh, right.
If the words are written down in advance, Sensible Sam could have, and frankly should have, reviewed that piece of paper before Rick ever drove to the monster truck rally.
That is so true.
The exam tests this concept heavily. A scripted presentation delivered to more than 25 retail investors is treated exactly like a mass email or a billboard.
So it's retail.
It's a retail communication, and it requires principal pre-approval.
So this is where the exam tries to get you with what we call the seminar split personality trap. A single seminar can actually have two completely different sets of rules running at the exact same time.
It absolutely can, and it happens every day in the real world. Imagine Rick hosts a retirement seminar for 30 retail prospects at a local steakhouse.
Right.
During the event, he is standing at the front of the room, speaking freely, and taking impromptu questions from the audience. Those spoken, unscripted words are a public appearance.
Right, so no pre-approval is required, just prior training.
Right. But before the seminar started, Rick placed a beautifully printed slide deck and a firm brochure on the chairs for those 30 attendees.
Ah, those written handouts are retail communication.
Yes.
Because they are physical written materials going to more than 25 retail investors.
Exactly. And those handouts must be pre-approved by Sensible Sam before the seminar begins.
Wow.
You can have a perfectly compliant, well-supervised public appearance happening vocally while simultaneously committing a massive FINRA violation because you didn't get your physical handouts pre-approved.
The spoken word is fluid. The printed word is locked down. I love that.
Exactly.
So what happens when Rick actually opens his mouth during that public appearance? Let's say he goes on live radio and recommends a specific security. What disclosures does he have to make live on the air?
So if a rep recommends a security during a public appearance, they must have a reasonable basis for that recommendation.
Right. That's just the baseline of suitability.
Yes. But they also must disclose any financial interest they or their firm have in that security, unless that interest is purely nominal.
Okay.
So if Rick personally owns 10,000 shares of the individual tech stock he's pumping on the radio, he has to tell the audience.
Yeah, that makes sense.
He also has to disclose any other material conflict of interest he knows about or if his firm makes a market in that security.
Okay, listener, pay extremely close attention to this next part. This is a crucial exception, specifically for the Series 6 exam. Rick isn't selling individual tech stocks. He is a Series 6 registered rep.
Right.
His license only allows him to sell investment company securities, you know, like mutual funds and variable products. Does he still have to disclose his personal financial interest when he recommends a mutual fund on the radio?
No, he does not.
Wait, really?
Really. The financial interest and conflict of interest disclosures do not apply to recommendations of investment company securities or variable insurance products.
That seems counterintuitive.
Yeah.
I mean, if the SEC wants transparency, why give mutual funds a free pass on conflict disclosure? Why doesn't Rick have to say he owns the fund he's pitching?
Well, because you have to look at the practical reality of what Series 6 reps do. Mutual funds are what they sell every single day. They are highly regulated pooled investments.
Okay.
If a rep had to legally disclose a financial interest every single time they mentioned a mutual fund they were licensed to sell, or a fund they held in their own 401k, the disclosure would just become meaningless, constant noise.
Right. It would just be white noise.
It would drown the client in useless verbal red tape. The practical application for your exam is this. If a question asks what a Series 6 rep must disclose when recommending a mutual fund at a seminar, the answer is simply that they must have a reasonable basis for the recommendation.
That's it.
That's it. They do not need to read off a laundry list of market-making or financial interest disclosures for mutual funds.
That is a massive distinction. Okay, so we figured out what buckets Rick's communications go into. We know how his seminars are split between spoken and written rules. Now, let's look at the actual words Rick is putting on paper.
Okay.
Sensible Sam is sitting at his desk, staring at a draft of a retail communication Rick just submitted. What are the content standards? Like, what are the baseline rules that apply to everything Rick writes?
The baseline rules apply across the board. Correspondence, retail, and institutional. All communications must be based on principles of fair dealing and good faith.
Okay. Fair dealing.
They must be fair and balanced. And crucially, they cannot omit any material fact if leaving that fact out makes the piece misleading.
Fair and balanced is easy to say, but what does it mean in practice? Like, can Rick say, this growth mutual fund is guaranteed to make you rich because I looked at my crystal ball and the market is going up?
Absolutely not. You cannot predict or project performance. You cannot imply that past performance will recur.
Right.
There are no crystal balls allowed in fine array communications.
Are there any exceptions to the no projecting performance rule? Like, what if I use a calculator?
There are very specific mathematical exceptions. You can use a hypothetical illustration of mathematical principles.
Like what?
For example, a compound interest calculator on a website is fine because it just shows how math works. It doesn't predict a specific investment's return.
Oh, I see.
You can use an interactive investment analysis tool provided it meets Fenneray's criteria. And in equity research reports, analysts can publish a price target provided it has a reasonable basis. But that's it. You cannot project the future of a specific client's portfolio.
What about past performance? If a mutual fund actually returned 10% last year, can I put that in my brochure?
Yes. Showing standardized past performance is allowed because it is history, not a projection.
Because it actually happened.
Right. It actually happened. You just can't append a promise to it. You can't say it did 10% last year, so you will get 10% next year.
Okay, let's put two phrases side by side because the exam absolutely loves this word swap.
Oh, I know where you're going with this.
Yeah, it's the difference between tax-free and tax-deferred.
Yeah.
Tax-free means the IRS never touches the earnings.
Right.
Like the interest generated by a municipal bond at the federal level.
Exactly. The growth is never taxed. You get to keep all of it.
But tax-deferred, which is what variable annuities and traditional IRAs are, means you are just beaking the can down the road.
Yep.
You pay ordinary income tax eventually when you take the money out. It is not eliminated. It is postponed.
That is the vital distinction.
So let's run a scenario. Reckless Rick makes a Facebook post. He writes, come buy this amazing variable annuity. It offers totally tax-free growth. Sam sees this post. Why is Sam sprinting out of his office having a panic attack?
Because Rick just committed a massive fraud violation.
Right.
A variable annuity is tax-deferred, not tax-free.
Hmm.
When the client eventually retires and starts taking withdrawals, they're going to pay ordinary income tax on all those earnings. If Rick tells them it's tax-free, he is materially misstating the fundamental nature of the product. This creates catastrophic civil liability for the firm.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, if a client buys that annuity thinking they will never pay taxes, the firm is going to get sued into oblivion and FINRA is going to drop the hammer.
Okay, seriously, if you learn one thing today, never, ever call an annuity tax-free. It is tax-deferred. Lock that in.
Write it down.
So what about comparing investments? Let's say Rick wants to show how aggressive and great his mutual fund is. So he compares it to a simple bank CD.
Okay.
He creates a beautiful chart for a brochure that says, bank CD yield, 4%. My mutual fund yield, 8%. He doesn't say anything else. Is that compliant?
No, it's highly non-compliant. When you compare investments, you're often comparing apples to oranges.
Right.
If Rick compares a mutual fund to a bank CD, he must disclose all material differences between those two products. He cannot just highlight the yield to make the mutual fund look superior.
Because the CD has superpowers that the mutual fund doesn't have. It has guarantees.
Exactly. He must explicitly mention with equal prominence that the CD is FDIC insured and the principal is completely safe.
Right.
In stark contrast, the mutual fund fluctuates in value, has no federal insurance, and guarantees absolutely nothing. If you show the upside of the yield, you must show the downside of the risk.
You can't put the 8% yield in massive size 72 neon font and hide the risk of losing all your money in microscopic size 4 font at the bottom of the page.
No, you cannot.
It has to be fair and balanced. Okay, let's touch on testimonials real quick.
Mm-hmm.
Rick pays a local minor league baseball player $150 to say he's a great financial advisor in a radio ad. Is that allowed?
It is allowed, but it comes with strict disclosure requirements.
Which are?
If Rick pays someone more than $100 for a testimonial, he must prominently disclose that it was a paid testimonial.
Right.
He must also state that the person's experience may not be representative of the experience of other customers and that the testimonial guarantees no future success or performance.
And what if Rick uses backtested or hypothetical performance in a piece of marketing? Like, if you had invested in this model portfolio 10 years ago, you'd be rich, that kind of thing.
Any hypothetical or backtested performance must be clearly and prominently labeled as such. It cannot be mixed up with actual performance where a client might confuse the two.
Right.
It has to be crystal clear that this is a mathematical simulation, not a real track record.
Okay, we are moving into the meat and potatoes for a Series 6 rep, the mutual fund and variable product gauntlet.
Yes, the heavy hitters.
The SEC has incredibly specific, almost paranoid rules just for these products because they fall under the Securities Act of 1933.
And their paranoia is entirely justified. The Securities Act of 1933 strictly prohibits offering a security to the public without a prospectus.
Right.
But advertising is an offer. So the SEC had to solve a paradox. How can a mutual fund advertise on television or in a magazine without physically handing the viewer a 100-page legal document?
Right. Because you can't hand a prospectus through a TV screen.
Hmm.
This is where the exam tries to get you with how the SEC threads that needle. Let's talk about the open-end fund advertising rule.
Okay.
Let's say Rick makes an ad for the Supergrowth Mutual Fund, and he puts their specific performance data, like their actual returns, right in the middle of the ad. What is this advertisement legally considered?
Legally, that advertisement is a prospectus.
Wow.
Specifically, it is deemed an omitting prospectus under SEC Rule 482. Because it includes specific performance data about a specific fund, it triggers incredibly strict standardized requirements.
So he can't just say, we had a great three-year run. Look at our amazing three-year return.
No. If he shows performance, he must show the standardized one-year, five-year, and 10-year average annual total returns.
All three.
All three. Or the life of the fund if it hasn't been around for 10 years. He cannot cherry-pick just a three-year return. He has to show the good, the bad, and the ugly over 1, 5, and 10 years.
And the logic there is brilliant. Cherry-picking a three-year window might just capture a lucky bull market where everything went up.
Exactly.
But forcing them to show a 10-year return forces the fund to show how they handled a recession or a market crash.
Exactly. It creates an apples-to-apples comparison for the investor, ensuring they see the full historical context.
Now, what about the generic fund advertising safe harbor?
Hmm.
What if Rick just makes an educational YouTube video called How Mutual Funds Work, and he talks about the concepts of diversification, pooling money, and professional management, but he never actually names a specific mutual fund?
Because he doesn't name a specific security, it is legally not an offer of a specific security.
Okay.
Therefore, it is not a prospectus. It falls under the generic safe harbor. It's just educational marketing.
Okay, wait, hold on. Let me push back on this. Let's go back to that first ad, the specific one with the performance data that we said is legally an omitting prospectus.
Okay.
What if Rick takes that specific ad and he dutifully files it with Fundera, pays their filing fee, and they give it a stamp of approval? Does filing it with Fundera magically stop it from being a prospectus? Like, why would Fundera approve something that carries that heavy legal weight?
That is a massive exam trap, so I'm glad you brought it up. Filing with Fundera is just a regulatory administrative checkbox.
Yeah.
Fundera is a self-regulatory organization. They are just checking to make sure you follow their formatting rules. But the SEC is federal law. Filing with Fundera never, ever changes the legal status of the document under the Securities Act of 1933.
Right.
If the ad names a specific fund and shows performance, it is an omitting prospectus, regardless of whether Fundera has a copy of it in their filing cabinet.
So do not fall for the Fundera filing magic trick. Filing it doesn't change what it fundamentally is.
Mm.
Speaking of prospectuses, let's talk about the summary prospectus rule.
Sure.
The reality is, nobody wants to read 100 pages of dense legal jargon before buying a mutual fund.
Right. And the SEC realized that, so they allow funds to deliver a short, plain English summary prospectus. It covers 9 key items like fees, risks, investment objectives, and past performance.
Which is much better.
It's much more digestible for the average retail investor.
But what if wealthy Wendy reads the summary and says, you know, Rick, I am a financial nerd. I want the full, unabridged statutory prospectus. Send it to me.
If the investor asks for the full statutory prospectus, Rick has a hard, unforgiving deadline. He must send it within exactly 3 business days of receiving the request.
Got a reasonable time, not, you know, sometime next week when he gets around to it.
No, a hard 3 business days. The SEC does not mess around with prospectus delivery. If they ask for it, you provide it immediately.
Okay, let's shift from mutual funds to variable products. Mm-hmm. So variable annuities and variable life insurance. These are complex hybrid products. What are the big do-nots for Rick when he's writing marketing copy for a variable annuity?
The biggest one is liquidity.
Liquidity, okay.
Rick cannot imply that variable products are short-term or highly liquid investments. They are the exact opposite.
Right.
They're designed for long-term retirement savings. They have massive surrender charges in the early years.
What does that mean exactly?
Meaning, if you want your money back early, the insurance company keeps a huge percentage of it. Plus, if the client withdraws money before age 59 and a half, they face a 10% IRS tax penalty on the earnings.
Ouch.
Yeah, so any discussion of liquidity or access to funds in a variable product ad must be balanced with a very clear, prominent warning about these severe penalties and surrender charges.
And what about the guaranteed trap? Variable annuities often have these complex riders attached to them, like a guaranteed minimum death benefit or a guaranteed minimum income benefit.
Right.
So Rick writes in his brochure, hey, your investment in the stock market is guaranteed. Why is that so wrong?
Because the guarantee does not protect the investment return of the separate account. And we need to understand the mechanics here to see why.
Yeah, break that down for me.
When you buy a variable annuity, your premium goes into a separate account, which is invested in mutual fund-like sub-accounts in the stock market. That separate account can absolutely lose value. The guarantee is essentially an insurance wrapper provided by the insurance company's general account. And here is the crucial phrase you must know for the exam.
Ready.
The guarantee relies entirely on the claims-paying ability of the insurance company.
So if the insurance company backing the annuity goes bankrupt, your guarantee is completely worthless.
Exactly. The guarantee is only as strong as the insurance company issuing the policy. It does not mean the stock market can't go down, and it does not guarantee your separate account won't lose money.
Ah, I see.
Rick cannot make it sound like the investment itself is bulletproof.
Okay, listener, another direct question for you. We're testing timelines here, and the exam loves timelines. Let's say Rick actually does his job right for once.
A miracle.
Truly. He sits down with a client on the Tuesday, and he gets the customer to sign a complete application for a deferred variable annuity. Rick takes the paperwork, drives back to the office, and hands the complete application to Sensible Sam at the Office of Supervisory Jurisdiction, the OSJ, on Thursday.
Yep.
How long does Sam have to review and approve this transaction? Think about it. When does the clock start? Tuesday or Thursday?
The answer is 7 business days. But the trick, as you pointed out, is when it starts. The clock is 7 business days, starting from when the OSJ receives a complete and correct application.
Which in this story was Thursday.
Correct.
Not when the customer signed it on Tuesday.
Exactly. The OSJ needs those 7 days because variable annuities are highly complex, illiquid products. Sam has to do a deep suitability review to make sure Rick didn't just sell a 20-year lockup product to an 85-year-old woman who needs cash for medical bills.
Right. That would be terrible.
And if the application Rick handed in on Thursday was missing a signature or incomplete, the 7-day clock doesn't even start running until the missing information is provided.
Boom. Mark that down. 7 business days from OSJ receipt of a complete app.
So Rick has finally written a compliant piece of marketing. A miracle has occurred. He didn't promise tax-free returns. He didn't guarantee anything.
Great job, Rick. But he can't just hit send, can he? Because even a perfectly written email can trigger a violation if the firm doesn't create a paper trail first. Let's look at the administrative hoops. Approval, filing, and record keeping.
Okay.
Let's start with principal pre-approval.
So we established earlier that retail communications need registered principal pre-approval from Sam before first use. Sam must sign and date his approval, creating a physical or digital record that he reviewed it.
Right.
But remember the exceptions. Correspondence, institutional communications, and public appearances only need supervision, not pre-approval.
Are there any retail communications that escape pre-approval? Like, what if Rick is arguing with people on a Reddit investing forum? Thousands of retail investors are seeing his posts. Does Sam have to pre-approve every single Reddit comment?
No. Interactive online forum posts, like Rick arguing on Reddit or responding in a live Twitter thread, are exempt from pre-approval.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Because of their interactive real-time nature, they act more like correspondence or a public appearance. A principal just can't pre-approve a Reddit debate in real time.
That makes sense.
Also, generic non-promotional materials or materials that don't make a financial recommendation, like just a general market update, are generally exempt from pre-approval too.
Okay, so that's internal approval. Sam signs off.
Mm.
But what about filing with FINRA? When does FINRA actually demand to see the marketing material in their own offices?
This depends heavily on how long the broker-dealer has been in business and what the communication is actually about. Let's do a direct comparison side by side because the exam will absolutely test the difference between new firms and established firms.
Okay, let's say Rick and Sam just left their old job and started a brand new broker dealer. It's their first year of FINRA membership. What's the rule for them?
For new firms in their first year of membership, they are essentially on probation. They must file broadly disseminated retail communications with FINRA at least 10 business days before first use.
Before?
Yes. FINRA wants to double-check their homework before it goes public because they just haven't earned the regulator's trust yet.
Okay, but what if they are an established firm? They've been around for 10 years, they have a solid track record.
For established firms, the general rule is they don't have to file everything. But T, if they create a retail communication specifically about mutual funds or variable products, they must file it within 10 business days after first use.
So new firms are 10 days before. Established firms for these specific products are 10 days after.
Exactly. It's pre-use versus post-use filing, entirely based on firm tenure.
And finally, record retention. How long do they have to keep all these brochures, emails, and Reddit posts in the filing cabinet?
Everything must be kept for 3 years from the date of last use. And for the first 2 years, it must be readily accessible, meaning they can pull it up immediately if an auditor walks in the door.
I want to hammer home that word OST. Listener, think about this analogy. If Rick designs a beautiful brochure in 2020 and he keeps using it, printing more copies, handing it out at seminars all the way until 2025, the 3-year clock does not start in 2020.
No, it does not. If it started in 2020, the record would expire in 2023 while he was still actively using the brochure.
Exactly. It starts the day he throws the very last copy of that brochure into the recycling bin in 2025.
Yep.
That piece of paper, even though it was originally created in 2020, lives in the firm's compliance files until 2028, 3 years from the date of last use.
It's a running clock that resets every single time you use the material. The regulators need a 3-year look-back window from the last time a client could have potentially been influenced by that marketing piece.
Sensible Sam's filing cabinets must be massive.
Oh, they are.
All right, just when Rick thinks he's safe, he decides to get fancy with his marketing. He wants to use rankings, volatility ratings, and 529 college savings plans in his ads. Let's cover the niche rules for these weird outliers.
Okay, let's do it.
What about investment company rankings? Rick wants to put a big gold star on his brochure that says, "My fund is the number one fund in the universe."
He can't just make that up. Huh. Rankings used in retail communications must come from an independent ranking entity. Think of organizations like Morningstar or Lipper. A mutual fund cannot create its own award to give to itself.
The Reckless Rick Award for Excellence in Mutual Funds. Not allowed.
No, surprisingly not. And the rankings must cover those standardized periods we talked about earlier, 1, 5, and 10 years. You generally cannot use a ranking that covers a period of less than 1 year.
Wait, is there any exception to that? What if there's a 6-month ranking based purely on yield, like highest yielding fund of the last 6 months?
That is the one exception. If a ranking is based purely on yield, it can be for a period of less than 1 year. But if it's based on total return, the absolute minimum time horizon is 1 year.
Okay, here's a gotcha for the rankings. What if a fund creates a totally new ranking category, like best tech fund managed by a guy named Steve?
Okay.
It's not a generally published category,
right,
but an independent entity technically verifies the data.
If it is a totally new category that isn't generally published, or if the fund created the category itself, the firm must file this communication with FINRA 10 days before first use. Yes, along with all the underlying data to prove it's not a scam. Even for an established firm that normally files after use, a made-up category triggers pre-use filing.
FINRA says, hold on, prove this Steve category is a real statistical metric before you publish it.
Exactly.
Got it. Let's talk about bond fund volatility ratings. This is a very specific metric that measures how sensitive a bond fund's net asset value is to interest rate changes and broader economic factors.
Yes. And the golden rule here for the exam, never ever call this a risk rating.
No.
It is a volatility rating. It measures price sensitivity, not the overall risk of default. If Rick's ad calls it a risk rating, he fails. It misleads the investor about what the rating actually evaluates.
Let's end these outliers with 529 plans. These are college savings plans, but legally, they're technically municipal fund securities.
Right.
Which means they aren't regulated directly by FINRA. They are regulated by the MSRB, the Municipal Securities Rulemaking Board.
Yes. Because they fall under MSRB jurisdiction, the pre-approval for a 529 plan advertisement must come from a municipal securities principal or a general securities principal, not just any standard investment company principal.
Okay, but what is the big disclosure trap for 529s? This is a huge real-world issue.
the out-of-state disclosure, many states offer state income tax deductions or credits, but only if you invest in your own home state's 529 plan.
Right.
So if Rick runs an ad in New York for a Nevada 529 plan, he must include a prominent warning that says essentially, hey, check if your home state offers better tax benefits before you buy this out-of-state plan.
Because if you don't warn them, they might buy the Nevada plan from you and miss out on massive tax deductions in New York.
Exactly.
Is there any time Rick doesn't need to include that disclosure?
The only time the disclosure is not required is if the advertisement is distributed solely to residents of the sponsoring state.
Okay, give me an example.
So if Rick is advertising a Nevada 529 plan, and the ad only runs in local Nevada newspapers or on Nevada local radio, he doesn't need the out-of-state disclosure because no out-of-state residents are seeing it. But if he puts it on a national TV spot or an unrestricted public website, you know.
Boom. Disclosure required because anyone in the country could see it, and they need to be warned about their home state benefits.
Exactly. The medium dictates the reach, and the reach dictates the disclosure.
All right, take a deep breath. We've covered a massive amount of ground. Let's bring the energy up for the final sprint.
Let's do it.
We are heading into the rapid fire recap. Time to lock in the absolute top points for exam day. I'm going to throw the concepts. You give me the testable takeaway. Ready?
Ready.
The magic line between correspondence and retail communication.
25 retail investors within any 30 calendar day rolling period. 25 or fewer is correspondence. More than 25 is retail.
The institutional wealth.
One single retail investor ruins an institutional communication. If even one retail investor receives it, it instantly downgrades to a retail communication or correspondence.
The seminar split personality.
Unscripted spoken words equal a public appearance. Written handouts or scripted readings delivered to more than 25 retail investors equal a retail communication that absolutely needs principal pre-approval.
The word swap that will get you sued.
Never call a variable annuity tax-free. It is tax-deferred. You pay taxes eventually.
The omitting prospectus.
Open-end fund ads that show specific performance are deemed prospectuses. They must show standardized 1-year, 5-year, and 10-year returns to prevent cherry-picking.
The variable annuity principal approval clock.
The 7 business days, starting from the moment the OSJ receives a complete and correct application, not when the client signs it.
And the filing cabinet rule.
Records must be kept for 3 years from the date of asked use. The clock resets every time you use it.
Awesome. Listener, you've got this. You know how to classify the buckets. You understand the SEC's paranoia around prospectuses. You know how to handle the seminars. And you know exactly how to keep Sensible Sam from firing Reckless Rick. But before we go, I'm going to kick it over for one final provocative thought to chew on as you study.
We've spent this entire time talking about rules designed for print brochures, television interviews, and mass emails. But think about how these 1930s Securities Act concepts map onto modern technology.
Right.
What happens with TikTok influencers or ephemeral Instagram stories that disappear in 24 hours? How does a 3-year record retention from last use work when a black box algorithm randomly pushes a 3-year-old video back into a user's feed?
Oh, wow.
Does that reset the compliance clock? As you study, think about how modern technology strains these very rigid analog rules. Because understanding that friction, understanding why the regulators struggle to adapt, might just help you predict the hardest conceptual questions the exam can throw at you.